Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to the Weekly Critic podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the excellent writer Sam Rubinstein. He's written for The Critic, but also The Spectator and Engelsberg Ideas, and he's a postgraduate history student. Sam, how are you today?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you. And thank you for coming on the podcast. Sam, you've written some pieces recently for our print magazine about kind of contested historical concepts. You wrote one about the term Anglo-Saxon. You've written one for our most recent magazine about the concept of the Dark Ages. What makes history such a kind of bloodstained ideological battleground? Because if you come at it in a more naive way, if you're an outsider, someone like, very much like myself, you might consider history as just kind of a way of working out the facts and kind of building a narrative around those facts, but you might not appreciate just how much conflict is entailed. So what is it that makes it such a fractious field?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the nature of history as a discipline at the moment, how fractious it is, makes it very difficult for people who take the attitude that you do, where they just want to sort of, you know, bury themselves in the archives and find out what the past was like. I think there are sort of two different ways to kind of address your question. One is looking at the historical discipline, so academic historians working usually in universities, writing monographs and papers about very specific things. And what's striking, I think, is how politicized that's become. And then there's the broader, the role played by history in bigger sort of social and cultural debates. I mean, I do find it striking that a lot of the sort of culture wars have this kind of historiographical component. So people on either side of these debates will try to support their arguments with appeals to the past. And you see that sort of infiltrating academic scholarship. So there's a great emphasis now on historians making sure that their work contributes to usually sort of progressive political discourse in some way. And I think a lot of historians feel quite insecure about themselves if they're not doing that. They feel that they have some kind of moral responsibility to contribute to these sorts of things. So yes, it's partly the pressures within the profession itself and partly the fact that there's a very voracious appetite for historical grounding for various fashionable ideas.
Absolutely. I mean, history obviously has always been different political biases. No one ever read Eric Hobsbawm and thought, you know, I'm just getting the straight facts here. But it does feel like almost every little element of history now has to be contested. For one of our magazines, you wrote about the term Anglo-Saxon and this kind of discourse about whether the term itself has all of these kind of racist connotations. How does a debate like this even begin? Because as far as I could understand from your article, this is not kind of a long storied debate. It's almost one that sprang out of nowhere. Is that fair to say?
Not just sprang out of nowhere. I mean, I think I mentioned in the article, it springs from one very particular person who is a Canadian literary scholar called Mary Rambrun Alton. And prior to her intervention, this is back in, I think, 2019, when she resigned from the International Society of Anglo-Saxonists and began to write a series of articles criticizing the term Anglo-Saxon. Prior to her, I don't think this was at all discussed. I mean, certainly historians in America have, I think, always been conscious of the fact that Anglo-Saxon is sometimes used as a sort of watchword for neo-Nazis and the far right. In Britain, I don't think that's had much of an impact at all, where the term has very different connotations and I think usually does... It does tend to be used to signify the Anglo-Saxon people and the Anglo-Saxon period, you know, the Germanic inhabitants of lowland Britain from the 5th century through to 1066. So I think it is the story. This isn't, you know, there are some culture wars in history that are very much the product of a kind of groundswell of, you know, a generation of students getting angry about a particular thing. I think this is slightly different. I think this is one person who makes the point very forcefully and very aggressively. And in so doing, is able to browbeat other people into taking her view, people who, you know, can't really be bothered to fight these sorts of things, and, you know, understandably think the stakes are extremely low. And if someone's calling you a racist for using the term, you know, you may as well just stop losing and stop using it.
It's obviously, this is a term that has been used in a political way by unsavory elements. But I mean, I guess the logical response to that should be saying, no, these guys who've claimed it don't deserve to claim it. That's not what it means. Whereas it sounds like she said, well, actually, because they're using it in this bad way, we must condemn the term itself. Almost as if somebody used a hammer for a violent crime. So you're saying, no, we can't use hammers anymore.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's interesting because it has actually been used, and this is a point that I make in my article. It's not true that, you know, the only political application of the term Anglo-Saxon has been kind of racist or far right. It has, I mean, it's amazing how frequently you find it, for example, in sort of 19th century radical literature and Chartist literature, which, of course, Marxist historians, I mean, you mentioned Hobsbawm earlier and Hobsbawm's colleagues certainly like the term. E.P. Thompson uses it, and so on. So it's been put to all sorts of uses, and it is peculiar, I think, to suggest that because one of these uses is something that we fiercely object to, the whole term needs to be discarded altogether, despite the fact that there are very sound historical reasons for using it. So that's what's also strange about Rambaran Olm's arguments, is that she tries to contend not only is the term bad because it's been used by racists and therefore we should disassociate from that, but also, she says, the term is anachronistic, it's unscholarly. So, I mean, to my mind, that suggests a bit of insecurity on her part, that she sort of knows that she's not really going to convince people simply by saying this is a term used by racists, therefore we can't use the term. She also needs to supply a kind of sturdier historical foundation for that by saying, well, the Anglo-Saxons didn't think of themselves as an Anglo-Saxon, and therefore we shouldn't. It's anachronistic for us to impose this label upon them.
But as you write in your piece, we can refer to Germans who wouldn't have thought of themselves as German.
We can, absolutely. I mean, I don't buy this idea that it's sort of in some way inappropriate to use a term to describe people that they wouldn't use themselves. But what's particularly perplexing in the Anglo-Saxon case that we do have some references, not many, but some, from the time, referring to themselves as Anglo-Saxon. So the whole argument, again, I think is extremely strange. And even if we didn't have that, we'd certainly have a wealth of documentary evidence to suggest that they think of themselves as Angles and Saxons. So it would still be fine, I think, as a matter of convention to sort of hyphenate the two. But yeah, the idea that it's a sort of anachronism invented by later historians is false.
And do you think these arguments gain traction because of a certain measure of professional cowardice, where it's almost like the most forceful and aggressive argument is winning because other voices are thinking, well, you know, I don't really want to die on this hill, to use a modish phrase, so I'll just let it slide.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes you read articles about sort of the crisis in academia that implies that every academic historian is a kind of, you know, Marxist revolutionary who, you know, and this isn't true. You know, the average Anglo-Saxon historian is not some sort of far left extremist. The average Anglo-Saxonist just wants to be left alone to look at their charters and their coins and read the sources in the Old English and the Latin. They just don't want to be embroiled in these sorts of debates. These debates are tiring. Obviously, nobody wants to be smeared as a racist, which of course was the modus operandi of Mary Rambaran Olm and her coterie. So, you know, it is cowardice, I suppose, in a sense. But I do also sympathise with historians who, as you say, don't want to die on that hill. And, you know, fundamentally, it doesn't really affect them either way. And there is this anxiety that that you do see that if you use terms like Anglo-Saxon, that will sort of immediately put off particularly sort of, Black historians who may otherwise want to contribute to the discourse. And I mean, I think it's a very sort of condescending line to take. But that is certainly something you see from a few Anglo-Saxon historians who want to justify why they're not using the term, is they'll say, well, even if I don't think it's racist, other people might, and therefore, why bother using it?
Which, as you say, is heavily implying that these other people are much less objective and more sensitive than themselves, which is not a very respectful attitude to take in itself.
Exactly. And again, as a point that I made in my article is, you often see Mary Rambronholm and people like her say, well, this explains why Anglo-Saxon studies has always been dominated by, you know, people who identify themselves as being ethnically Anglo-Saxon in a sense. And I think that this is a major disservice to the very many non-ethnically Anglo-Saxon historians of Anglo-Saxon England. I mean, the two outstanding examples, probably the outstanding example is Felix Liebermann, who was a Jew, who certainly, the British historian F.W. Maitland reviewed his edition of Anglo-Saxon Laws and makes the point very movingly. He says, I can't quote it exactly, but he says something to the effect of the worst elements in German society will disown him, basically. This was in 1905 or thereabouts, or 1904, I think. The worst elements in German society, i.e. anti-Semites, this is decades before the Holocaust, will want nothing to do with Felix Liebermann because he's a Jew. But we, the English, he says, we can claim him as our own because we respect his outstanding scholarship.
Do you think when these debates arise, there's a certain, or at least there's the potential for a certain amount of professional as well as political opportunism? And as much as academia, even as an outsider, I know that it's so competitive now. It's such a crowded field. There's a kind of incentive to produce the novel and the emotionalistic argument because you're really going to get a professional head start, not even necessarily in this incident, but just in other cases where these debates just spark up like, you know, fire starting from a spark.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's been a very well publicized case of exactly this recently with Jenny Bulstrode and the court affair, where she wrote an article a few months ago. It's hugely well publicized, effectively suggesting that, I'm not an expert in 18th and 19th century in industrial history and scientific history, but her argument, as I understand it, is that she refers to the theft of Black African knowledge via a Jamaican foundry by English industrialists, particularly Henry Cort. And what's come out since then, thanks to the work of Anton Howes and the work of Oliver Jelf, a master's student, is that she has, I mean, if we're being charitable, she has misread the sources. And there were articles in the BBC and The Guardian effectively saying, you know, the Industrial Revolution was on the back of Black slaves. And we can prove this by tracing the origin of this particular innovation in metallurgy. So there is certainly an incentive on particularly young academic scholars to produce narratives that appeal to the zeitgeist.
You've written a piece for our latest magazine about the concept of the Dark Ages and how people who study it attempted to think of it in much lighter terms. You write about academics who, having devoted much of their lives to illuminating the period, have developed a natural sympathy towards it and hope to rescue it from the condescension of posterity. And I know this is something that's bled down through the culture because it's something I've encountered myself. And I think there's this instinct when you've gained this received wisdom about something in history and you begin to doubt yourself. You think, oh, maybe I was just, you know, a sheep going along with the herd. But your article is fairly skeptical towards this kind of revisionism. So how much power do you think there is in the argument that the Dark Ages were not as dark as we've been told?
Well, I mean, I should draw a distinction between these two articles, the Anglo-Saxon one and the Dark Ages one. Anglo-Saxon is a descriptive claim, a descriptive signifier. Dark Ages is a value judgment.
Yeah.
And historians should be free to disagree on value judgments. And there is, as I say in my article, that there are some, you know, contemporary political reasons why there's a sort of objection to the term. I think this is linked to ideas about the fall of Rome. So a lot of historians really want to underplay how calamitous the fall of Rome was, because they see narratives about the sort of the fall of Rome and the rise of barbarism as potentially, again, being exploited by sort of anti-immigration right-wing rhetoric. And historians, indeed, are often very open about this. So I cite in my article the case of Guy Halsall, who says exactly this in one of his articles. You know, historians should be more morally responsible, and we have a duty not to present the fall of Rome as this sort of calamitous event, and not to present it as you know, Rome being sacked by barbarians, because if we don't do that, then you know, far right agitators will use this in their arguments against against immigration and so on. But there are people object to the Dark Ages for all sorts of reasons. The great Catholic historian Christopher Dawson rejected it because, of course, if you're a Catholic, as he says, they're not dark at all. This is the age in which the world, you know, is converted to Christianity. It's certainly less dark than, you know, what had come prior. You know, these are aesthetic judgments, and generally the idea of the Dark Ages has been associated with a kind of humanism, a suspicion of religion. So of course you see this particularly in Edward Gibbon, but often sort of Dark Ages memes, certainly in the sort of early 2000s and so on, that was very much associated with the kind of the new atheism as proof of the terrible decline in learning brought about by the rise in Christian superstition. So yes, it's not an objective judgment. It is rather, as Lucy Varga put it in the 1930s, it's a battle cry. And I suppose all I'm trying to say in my article is that both sides can use that battle cry. And there have been two books published very recently, one called The Light Ages and one called The Bright Ages, both of which obviously flip the formula on the head. And all I'm saying is, well, if they are entitled to do that, then those of us, and I very much include myself in this number, who do look at the early Middle Ages and think, God, what a terrible time that would have been to be alive, we should be able and permitted to use the traditional pejorative nomenclature.
Yeah, it's as you say, it's a much more legitimate debate. And history does always evolve, because there are these different narratives, and sometimes people look back and decide that they must be revised. I mean, there's nothing necessarily wrong with revisionism. There's just good revisionism and bad revisionism. But
absolutely,
why do you think this term, which, as you say, does contain an element of a value judgment, why do you think it is merited?
I draw a lot of my conclusions about this from a brilliant book published about 20 years ago called The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization by a historian at Oxford and archaeologist, actually, Brian Ward Perkins, where I think he lays bare, you know, what was lost when the Western Roman Empire fell in the 5th century. And to my mind, the evidence is pretty striking and pretty damning. There is, as I say in my article, there, after that point, there is simply less of everything. There is less graffiti. And from that, we can infer, for example, that people across society became less literate. And indeed, you need to wait a very long time before you get rulers writing again. You know, literacy had been sort of assumed in the Roman Empire of the emperors. It's not at all assumed of the barbarian kings who succeed them in Western Europe, for example. The bones of cattle become smaller after the 5th century, even smaller than before Rome, which is, I mean, one of the most striking things in that book, which suggests, of course, that agricultural practices were in decline, and that there was less food to nourish a probably shrinking population. There's less coinage. You know, if you find a 4th century coin of Constantine, that won't sell for very much at all these days, because there's so many of them. But if you find a coin from 2 centuries later, that's a prized artifact. So there's the sense that the whole economy regresses from a coinage-based currency to bartering. I mean, I think it is, by most objective standards, there is a sort of an intellectual cultural decline. Again, if you're a Catholic, you may look at that slightly differently. Although even then, you probably feel warmer towards, you know, Constantine than you do towards Theodoric and his more theologically confused successors, one might say. So, I mean, yes, I think there is a pretty steep decline. And that's not to say you don't find remarkable bouts of intellectual activity in what we traditionally term Dark Age Europe. You know, Bede in Northumbria, Boethius in Italy. There are certainly remarkable figures, but I think it is important to see them as pretty striking aberrations and exceptions.
I guess there's some extent to which some questions in history are unanswerable in as much as something like agricultural decline is something you can measure, whereas something like, I don't know, the spiritual value of a civilization. I mean, we can have different understandings of what that means. Like for some people, you could measure that in literacy. But if you come from a particular faith and there are more members of that particular faith, that's going to mean something to you that it's just not going to mean to an outsider. So we're always going to have these different interpretations which can never quite prevail over the other.
Exactly. Except in... And the Dark Ages is never going to be a settled matter. You know, I hope very optimistically that Anglo-Saxon will become settled and that, you know, there's this moment of frenzy, but sort of now that we've moved past that, and I think to a great extent we have historians down the line won't think twice about using the term. Dark Ages, I don't see it coming back anytime soon in historical writing, precisely because it's so laden, and it's so, you know, it's the sort of wide-ranging polemical term that historians generally try to avoid. I think we're now living in a moment of sort of antithesis, where people are, you know, writing books called the Bright Ages and the Light Ages and so on, because these books sell, because they seem to be in some way subversive and radical. But I think in the long run, it probably will drop out of historical discourse because it's not necessarily the most helpful term. But in a very sort of crude sense, I do think it's basically correct. And I quote Paul Graham, the computer scientist and investor and essayist, and he has this good line where he says, well, if the Dark Ages didn't exist, the term didn't exist, then there'd be very good reasons to invent it, to describe this period.
I suppose a reactionary pessimist could say that the Dark Ages will drop out of use to describe that period because it will need to describe ours.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, and that's something you often see early medievalists who, again, are often quite defensive of their period, and I think grow quite affectionate sometimes towards the people and the phenomena that they're studying. And you do often see them say, well, you know, actually, in some respects, the early modern period was a lot bloodier. And in some respects, of course, the 20th century is almost, I mean, by any definition, the bloodiest century in human history. So perhaps that's more aptly termed dark. And there is something to that. And I can understand why a lot of medieval historians are quite frustrated that some things that really aren't medieval are sort of back projected onto the Middle Ages. So the classic example is sort of is the witch craze. And people, I think, on a very basic level, often kind of associate the witch craze with sort of medieval ignorance and superstition. But it is very much an early modern phenomenon. You know, there are certainly traces of it in the Middle Ages, but in terms of the sort of conventional images of, you know, burning witches at the stake and Salem and all of this sort of thing, that's maybe more recent than we would like it to be, because we like to imagine a greater distance from that. So yeah, I mean, but by the same definition, in the same vein in which I refer to the early Middle Ages in Western Europe as a dark age, it's absolutely legitimate for people to look at the 20th century and say, well, that's the real dark age.
And of course, history never ends. We're still experiencing it tragically in very vivid detail right now. You've written some articles for us on more political themes, and a couple of articles you've written have been about the ways we describe bigotry, ways we diagnose bigotry. You wrote one piece for us, which was about the concept of the dog whistle, which is this kind of very, very subtle hint of racism that only the racist is meant to pick up on, but sometimes, not always maybe, but sometimes only exists within the minds of the people who sense its existence. You've written another piece for us about this kind of debate about whether racial prejudice and racism are distinct phenomena, and racism must exist in terms of kind of structural racism. I mean, right now on the streets, we're seeing people just delighted by some of the most heinous war crimes imaginable, which have taken place in Israel over the weekend. And yet there's a kind of sensitivity about describing it in the kind of terms of bigotry that on other occasions we see, just because people have used a slightly out of date term, or just because someone said something in the wrong tone of voice. Why do you think we're seeing this unwillingness to describe, well, let's bluntly call it the celebration of murder, in the terms of bigotry that we usually use?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. You mentioned the dog whistle point, and I do think this reinforces my idea that it's not necessarily a very helpful way of going about it. Because what the last few days have proved, I think, is that anti-Semites tend not to communicate with each other by dog whistles. They're actually a lot more forthcoming about it. This morning, various Black Lives Matter organizations in America, I think the Chicago chapter and the Los Angeles chapter, posted an image of a Hamas fighter with a hand glider. Is that a dog whistle? I'm not really convinced that it is. That is the only association between those two things was created a few days ago when Hamas terrorists descended on the rave in southern Israel near Gaza and proceeded to rape and massacre and kidnap. To my mind, that's not a dog whistle. That's an outright statement of support and solidarity with the murderers, specifically celebrating their act.
It's more of a dog murder. Bark, yeah. It's more of a dog bark. Exactly. You couldn't miss it.
Exactly. So, I mean, the last few days have obviously been very revealing, and I mean, I hope that anything to come out of this is that these sorts of institutions, these organisations, simply won't be taken seriously anymore as authorities on matters of racial justice and so on, now that they have very much, publicly and on the record, expressed their support for the horrific events of the last few days. Yes, your point about there being a sort of reluctance to call a spade on this and say, well, this is anti-Semitic bigotry. I mean, I have been heartened by the fact that most people have, I think, been rightly disgusted and horrified. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are of course exceptions, but actually there has been a remarkable degree of international unanimity. So, I mean, I'm sure you've seen images of the Israeli flag projected onto buildings throughout Europe. Biden's statement yesterday was extremely uncompromising and extremely solid. And all these people are willing to say that Hamas, I mean, what people have known for a very long time, which is that Hamas is a murderous anti-Semitic death cult. But of course, there have been people, very often academics, and I mentioned Black Lives Matter chapters earlier, there have been people not willing to say that this is, I'm not willing to condemn this horrific act. And what is really upsetting actually in a way is that actually, I mean, there is the sort of Jews don't count idea, the Badil style. Well, the reason they're not doing it is because they don't see Jews as an ethnic minority. And in some respect, they don't see Jews as sort of fully human. But I think it's worth remembering that a lot of the victims of the last few days aren't Jews at all, and they're not white by any definition. I mean, that includes sort of non-white Israelis who are an enormous population, but also migrant workers and migrant students. I think 10 Nepali students were killed. I'll need to check this, but I think it's 11 Thai migrant workers are currently held hostage in Gaza. So the victims of this are not, I mean, there is this idea, I think, that you see sometimes on the left and on the right, that Israel is a kind of, European settler colony. And therefore, if you take kind of Black Lives Matter ideas, I'm referring there to the organization, not the slogan, if you take them in their crudest form, basically any act of violence by, an oppressed person of color versus a non-oppressed white person is legitimate and valid. But that doesn't, so I think a lot of people are seeing it through that prism, but it's not, it doesn't at all capture what's been going on in Israel over the last few days by any definition. I do also think a lot of people, there's a sense in which Israel discourse is kind of fossilized, and people, I do think a lot of people just sort of went on to autopilot when they saw the news and kind of thought, well, I'm pro-Palestinian, so I know what to say. It's, I kind of know what lines to trot out. And I do think it's taken a while for it to really sink in that this is obviously just different from anything that's happened in Israel before. This is, I mean, as has been, the point's been made many times now, but this is the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. And probably the biggest massacre of Jews in Palestine, in Israel, since Jewish settlement there in the late 19th century, or an increased wave of Jewish settlement there. So I do think, yeah, a lot of people just sort of trotted out the usual lines before really realizing what made this so unique. I think a lot of them are facing the consequences of that. I do think they're a pretty small minority, the people cheering on Hamas in this case. And I think the bulk of public opinion, including people who tend to be more sympathetic to the Palestinian side of things, are completely appalled and horrified. And I think that will only increase in the coming days when more information comes out.
I think there are a lot of people as well who they don't approve of what Hamas did, obviously, but they're uncomfortable about acknowledging the gravity of the events. And I think that's because a lot of people have internalized this kind of punching up, punching down mentality, where they don't quite believe that people with less kind of overall material power can be the leading perpetrators of aggression. But I mean, you don't need to have the main overall power to have the main power for malice if you're willing to use it. So, I mean, it doesn't matter if someone's richer than another person, if the latter is willing to kill the former. So I wonder what kind of influence this will have on our discourse, where kind of mainstream society has been very unwilling to say, for example, that you could be racist against somebody who has more material power than you, or that you can have an oppressor among the supposed victims of imperialism as well as among the imperialists themselves. I wonder how this is going to reframe our discourse. I mean, you talked in your piece about Diane Abbott's recent response to Tom Owolade's book, where she was saying kind of, you know, you can have prejudice against Jews, but you can't have racism because there's no kind of structural racism. But what does it mean, whether it's structural or not, if there are people, you know, shouting Allah Akbar because a bunch of civilians got killed?
Well, precisely. And again, I mean, you know, Diane Abbott made a blunder in that article. She also said it was impossible to be racist towards Gypsy, Roma and traveller people, which meant that people who may otherwise have defended her were, I think, actually pretty taken aback. And the sort of Novara crowd, for example, were actually quite critical of her at the time. And again, I'm dubious that they would have been had she sort of focused on Jews specifically, because there has been this very trendy idea recently that it's not possible to be racist towards Jews, and indeed that it's not possible to be racist towards white people, all based on this idea that, which by the way is why people like David Baddiel are at pains to stress that Jews aren't in fact white, so you can sort of square that circle. You know, my position is that some Jews, certainly the vast majority of Jews in Britain, probably not in Israel, but the vast majority of Jews in Britain are white by any reasonable definition. I would feel quite strange if I didn't think of myself as white. I feel like I was sort of deluding people and myself. But it is possible to be racist towards white people for precisely the reasons you give, that racism isn't actually about structural power and all these things that churn out about that are churned out by, you know, sociology and political science faculties and this sort of thing. Racism is about violence and prejudice towards people on the basis of their race. I hope, I mean, you know, it's difficult to look for silver linings in any of this, but I hope that one effect of the last few days is that it will alert a lot of people who had sort of mindlessly intoned those sorts of fashionable arguments, that they are not remotely tenable. And even if Israel is oppressor, and even if Palestine is oppressed and so on, even if you would accept that underlying framework, it is still possible to view Hamas's actions as undeniably racist.
We've talked today about history, and we've talked about kind of, if you want to call it, developing history, about contemporary politics. What do you think should be the role of the historian as a historian in discourse surrounding current events? I mean, in the Israeli-Palestine debate, for example, you could have, I'm sure Benny Morris has commented on modern Israeli politics as well as Israeli history. Obviously, there have been some fairly controversial examples of pro-Palestinian historians commenting on modern Israeli and Palestinian politics. One thinks of Norman Finkelstein, for example. What do you think is the role of the historian in modern debate and not just historical debate?
I mean, I think people often want to hear historians' perspectives on these things, particularly, I mean, your examples of Israel-Palestine and Russia and Ukraine. I think there's a widespread feeling that you won't be able to understand these things unless you have a rich and a deep awareness of the history of these places. So in that sense, historians will always contribute to these sorts of debates because people will always want to listen to historians. And sometimes that's just for reasons of wanting to improve their own knowledge, and other times it's more polemical. You know, people want to be able to draw upon an expert historian in making their arguments. You know, a Palestinian activist may want to draw from Ilan Pappé, for example. And of course, you know, Putin himself has been fairly adept at sort of acquiring sort of superficially respectable Russian historians to kind of cement his imperialist claims on Ukraine. So I think, yeah, it always needs to be borne in mind that nobody has a monopoly on historical truth. Historians do disagree. Sometimes they disagree for, you know, pretty discomforting reasons, precisely because they allow the sort of contemporary politics to distort their view of things. But I mean, I think it is probably right and good that historians occupy or play a role in public debates. I do think, you know, the problems start when historians view their sort of political punditry as their main job and their main responsibility. And I mean, again, to go back to the Bulstrode case that I mentioned earlier, there may well be an element of that there. And certainly there are many historians who perhaps, like I say, they sort of feel potentially quite insecure that actually their research is maybe, you know, is not very consequential and maybe is only of interest to the 20 or 30 other diehard specialists in the world. And then they feel very insecure about this and sort of they want to have a bigger impact. And so I think that there are cases in which that does incentivize poor scholarly practice. I do think it's quite good for historians to try, it's very difficult, of course, but to try and have sort of two hats, as it were. They have their sort of research hat where they look at the evidence in as disinterested and objective a manner as is possible. And then they have their political opinions. Of course, there's always going to be a sort of a back and forth between the two, and it would be naive, I think, to pretend otherwise. And of course, historians often, you know, come to their political views precisely because of arguments that they make based upon the evidence that they look at in their day job. But I do think it's very important for historians not to allow their political prejudices or their sort of side gig as a political commentator to interfere with their research.
I think it was Wittgenstein who said that Bertrand Russell's books should be published in two colors, like his books on kind of hard mathematics and philosophy should be published in, I can't remember which way around it was, but red, and then his more popular books should be published in blue. And that's maybe a bit of an extreme perspective, but maybe there's not quite enough of a distinction sometimes being drawn between the research and the punditry. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely right. And I'm very conscious of this myself because I had my first academic publication a few months ago in a journal. And one of the things that weighed on my mind when I wrote it, and indeed when I write my articles, is, you know, I want to make sure that nobody, you know, nobody reads this and thinks, oh, well, this is, you know, this is a load of rubbish, because I know him and I've read his articles for The Critic, and I know he's politically motivated and biased. I mean, aside from using that term Anglo-Saxon, I hope, you know, I haven't given too much away in that peer-reviewed article. So yeah, I think historians probably should adopt that, what Wittgenstein said of Russell. They should probably take that to heart. It is possible to have those two hats, as it were, but I think it's important. You know, you're writing in a very different mode and a different style when you're a political commentator or pundit or whatever, and when you're writing a scholarly work, and that should be obvious to any reader. And the scholarly work should always be more balanced, obviously, you know, extremely well sourced, not distorting the primary evidence, and you shouldn't, you know, historians should not leave themselves open to the accusation that they are entirely politically motivated. You know, Hobsbawm, who you mentioned again earlier, of course, anyone who reads anything by Hobsbawm knows exactly where he stands politically, but that doesn't mean, you know, most of the time that he doesn't give serious consideration to other perspectives. I mean, he's a very interesting example because I read some of his memoirs recently, and he describes how the biggest influence on him as a student by far, when he was at Cambridge, was the historian Michael Poston, who was a ferociously anti-Marxist liberal. And I think that's a very good indication that, you know, historians in the past weren't allowing their political prejudices to sort of get in the way of their scholarly endeavours, and they weren't closing themselves off to other political influences.
And also, it's good to have scholars involved with punditry to some extent, because otherwise punditry is just reduced to loudmouths like me. So it's good to have a bit of erudition brought to the field sometimes. Excellent. Thank you, Sam, so much for talking to me today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.